this stuff going on. Jesus got all this stuff to accomplish. And yet, Jesus just kind of goes with the flow, doesn't he? I mean, you have that sense that now's the time, and he does this, and he does this. So what I want to get after is that sense of there's 12 hours of work for you. You know, God is not going to give you more than you can do. You might take on more than you can do, but that's your fault. You haven't listened to God, right? Right?
Right.
On the other hand, God is not going to give you less than 12. You know, God's, some people who are not very busy, it's not because that God doesn't have things for them to do, it's because they're lazy. It's because they're escaping. It's because they're not doing what maybe God might be calling them to do, right? So the whole idea of 12 hours a day gives me both sides, gives me a dialectical tension. And the only way to stay in that dialectical tension is to be hearing what God is wanting me to do. Because if I'm doing what God has called, then I'm not going to have too much to do. I'm not going to have too little to do. I'm going to have 12 hours worth. Okay? And it lets me set my pacing according to how God is at work in me. Well, now, that also teaches me a third thing. The third most important thing about time that teaches me is I better get directions how to use it. And I don't want to make that law. I want to make that gospel that God does want to give us directions. God does want us to know how best to use our time. And let me add a fourth. I wasn't going to say this one, but lest we lose part of the dialectic. A fourth part of it is I ought not to let my time be law. And so I dare to think that because there's 12 hours in a day means you have to work all 12 of them. You know, part of the tasks of the 12 hours might be the nap. Part of the tasks of the 12 hours might be sitting with your family and just enjoying life for a minute, you know, or an hour before. So the very fact of the 12 hours, we daren't let that be, I've got this terrible dialectic of not too much and not too little. We also want it to be the dialectic of letting it be gospel and not letting it be law. Which is why my point three in the middle of those four was, I want to get direction. Now, that invites me then to spiritual disciplines. It invites me to prayer. It invites me to Bible study. It invites me to the community, because the community helps me to know how to use my time. It invites me to see what my duties might be as far as my job. It invites me to think through, well, yeah, I do a job because it's important to earn bread. You got to live somehow. I mean, it invites us to do that kind of reflection about vocation, reflection about our hobbies, all the kinds of reflections that we're planning to do together here. So are there not 12 hours in the day? Now I want you to turn to Luke chapter 11. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Luke 13. I couldn't see the numbers in the dark. And Luke 13, would somebody read verses 31 to 33?
At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." He replied, "Go tell that fox, I will drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I will reach my goal. In any case, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day. For surely no prophet can die outside of Jerusalem."
Now that's an incredible, incredible section of scripture. Because here's the Pharisee, or some people, trying to warn Jesus and saying, you know, Herod's out to get you. Now can you imagine the audacity of Jesus that he just says, "Go tell that fox." I mean, he does not use fox as a nice term. I mean, it's pretty pejorative. You go tell that fox. And I mean, just to have the courage to say to this guy who's got power of life and death over him, Well, I've got my things to do. When it's time, it's time. And I'm going to heal today and cast out spirits, and I'll do that tomorrow too, and the third day, okay. The third day I'll show up in Jerusalem. Because, you know, Jerusalem is obviously going to be the place of his death. He knows that, and everything points to it. And as he heads toward Jerusalem, I mean, there's the next thing in the text, as you notice, is the weeping over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, you stone the prophets and you kill the ones that are sent to you. How often I would have gathered you, but you would not. So there's this pathos, this very tenderness in Jesus, which of course you would expect in Luke. I mean, Luke is the gospel of the pathos and the tenderness in Jesus. The weeping over Jerusalem. And as Jesus is very aware of that, he also says, okay, the first and the second and the third day. Now, that third day is highly symbolic. I mean, he's picking up the Jonah stuff. He's picking up the Hosea stuff. On the third day, we will see the Lord. He's picking up the whole sense of the divine that the number three it incorporates. Just this sense of my death is all part of the plan, you know. And once again, there's this very great sense that if I'm in God's hands, then the timing is going to be right. And I think above all, that's our goal in gathering together this weekend. That we want to work on various aspects of our lives and be more aware of the presence of God in those aspects. But underneath it all, we want this fundamental undergirding that my times are in God's hands. And therefore, I can, if I'm really listening to God, if I'm really wanting to be God's person, living out God's character, following Jesus, as we said the expression yesterday, as I'm following Jesus, then I want that to be lived out. I'm going to know how to spend my time. That will be given to me. It is a gift also. Now, let's look at the other side. It will help us to name the enemy. It will help us to be better aware of that positive sense of time if we do a real working of naming the enemy. So I want to spend most of the rest of the time talking about the idolatry of time and some of the things about time. And in the midst of it all, we'll kind of circle around the grace of it. And if I don't point out enough grace in here, call my attention to that. Because we want to keep coming back to the gospel in all of this. But I want to talk about some real realities of our idolatries. And when we break into our groups, we'll be theologizing about both the negative and the positive. The main point that I want to make next is a sense both of how busyness is a modern phenomena and how it's an ancient phenomena. I mean, it's been always the case. When you talk about busyness, a lot of times people will blame it on urbanization, technicization, the speeding up of the commute, the speeding up of computers, the speeding up of life processes and life changes, and it makes you feel busier. And so you kind of think, well, it's just this modern world. It's just changing too fast and going too fast. And I just can't keep up, and I have too much to do, and I'm therefore way too busy because life is too fast. So I'd like to read you a poem from the Chuang Tzu, which was translated into a modern idiom by Thomas Merton. And when was the Chuang Tzu? Does anybody know? I'm not real good about Chinese philosophy, but it was BC, wasn't it? Or early AD? Nobody. I'm glad you're as dumb about it as I am, so I could tell you anything and you'd believe me. Well, let's say it could have been later than the 6th century AD. It might have been as early as the 3rd century BC. So how's that for? Yeah, nails it down. Really good. What I want you to just realize is the pastness of this. You've got to be active. And what I want you to do is try and catch the point of this poem. It's called The Active Life. Now, in copying it, we made a mistake, and one paragraph we neglected to copy, so I'm gonna have to make it up. And I sort of remember how it went, but not exactly. I can't remember the sort of Chinese-sounding phrases. So since I had to make it up anyway, it's obviously made up, and I just used modern phrases. But it still makes the point. This is how the poem goes. Active life. If an expert does not have some problem to vex him, he is unhappy. If a philosopher's teaching is never attacked, she pines away. If critics have no one on whom to exercise their spite, they are unhappy. All such people are prisoners in the world of objects. He who wants followers seeks political power. She who wants reputation holds an office. The strong man looks for weights to lift. The brave woman looks for an emergency in which she can show bravery. The swordsman wants a battle in which he can swing his sword. People past their prime prefer a dignified retirement in which they may seem profound. People experienced in law seek difficult cases to extend the application of laws. Liturgists and musicians like festivals in which they parade their ceremonious talents. The benevolent, the dutiful, are always looking for chances to display their virtue. Be alive, get it done, save the world, meet the needs, do your thing, or else you will die of despair. The last line I know is how he translated, or else you will die of despair. What's the point of that poem? Yeah, it's making fun of us. To tell us what?
It kind of reminds me of that Murphy's Law that work expands to fill the time available.
Yes, and why are you expanding your work? Do you see that this poem is pointing out that you are busy because you have to justify your existence? You have to be busy to prove that you're worth it. If your identity is that you're brave, there better be some chances to show you're brave. Right? If your identity is to be a critic, you got to have something to pick at so that your powers of criticism can be evident to the world. This fits in with exactly what my professor, Walt Bowman, used to always say in doctrine class back in college. He used to always say, you've got to justify your existence. Now that's law.
It's paperwork.
Law is proving that I'm worth it. Now we do that in all sorts of ways, don't we? When I was in high school, I was really the class wallflower. And it was because of my home situation and all that kind of stuff. I was a Lutheran principal's kid, and that just didn't go over very well in this little town. And so I always felt like somehow I had to prove to my classmates that I was important. So I didn't care who I killed, just so I won. You know, I had to win everything because I had to justify my existence. And that was a terribly fretful way to live because somehow I needed to have people know that I mattered. And it wasn't until I was a junior in high school and I almost died. And I was going in and out of a coma and I was on a bed in the hospital realizing what a jerk I was. That I'd spent my whole life trying to prove to everybody that I was valuable. And that the result was I was a big snob. I don't think I'm totally purged of that sin, so forgive me. But isn't a lot of... You're guilty too, so don't laugh at me. Don't you spend a lot of your time trying to prove to people that they should value you? I mean, let's be honest, brutally honest, don't we? And we all get into these traps of trying to justify our existence, which is exactly what this poem is showing. And the fact that it's an ancient poem, I want to say busyness is a universal phenomenon when your busyness results from this human need to prove your worth. And so we can't lay the blame on a modern world that's too urbanized, too technicized, too industrialized, too fasticized. Fast foods kind of fasticized, you know? It's not a word, but pretend it is. We can't blame it on those outside things because then you would solve it outsidely. when the that's not a word either, but pretend it is. The problem is inside of us. Do I need to justify my existence? And if I locate the problem within myself, then time is a whole different piece. Because then I can do the things that I do, not to prove my worth, but to do them for the sake of doing them, or because that's my job to earn money to feed my family, or, you know, I can have better reasons. Sometimes it's just necessity. And necessity can be made from law into gospel if I realize that the gospel frees me to fulfill those necessities. But if I locate the problem outside of myself, do you see my point? And so as we talk about time and how we use our time, I want, especially this weekend, that we keep locating the problem where it needs to be located and therefore find the solution that's appropriate. So as I recognize it's something within myself, then I solve it. And here's the gospel. If I locate the problem within myself, I can live not as a reactor, but as an actor. If the problem is outside of me, then urbanization forces on me a speed, or transportation forces on me a speed, and I have to react to it. But if I locate the problem within myself, I can be an actor. I can say, I don't choose to go that fast. You know, if you have to be here at such a time, and I can't get there unless I break the law, I might choose not to break the law. I might choose to not get there. Tomorrow I might make other choices, like get up earlier so that I don't have to break the law. Do you see my point? I can, if I keep locating the problem inside myself, be an actor. And then it comes out of a free heart. And I'm using the heart in the Hebrew sense of it, an act of will. I can live out of my own choices. And that's the gospel. Now, another direction. I want to go in another direction. Let me stop bulldozing for a minute. And do you want to make any comments in reaction to that idea? The idea of locating the nature of the problem within ourselves.
Aren't we also looking at the process of doing instead of finding the solution? Because God has the solution. He is the one that has the last say, but yeah. We are going through the process.
Right. Good. And that enables us to be participatory mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. And also, that helps us in times when there is no solution.
Right.
You know, if there is no solution, we just at least make a good process out of it and learn from our failures when there's not a solution.
What about times when you're sort of forced into the situation of needing to sort of prove yourself or, you know...
Good point, Amy. You'd think I'd paid you to say that because that leads into the next thing. I think that it really does help us if we understand the tyranny of time. So for the next chunk of time, I would like to give you 7 points about the tyranny of time, just for understanding it. And a lot of these I got from Robert Banks, whose book, The Tyranny of Time, is one of the best ever. I don't know if they have that in the bookstore here or in the library. But it's a book I highly recommend. Robert Banks, The Tyranny of Time. If I remember right, it's published by InterVarsity Press. But mine is lent out, so I couldn't check that up. First thing, and this Robert Banks develops at length, and I just want to summarize it briefly. But time, we have got to always remember, is an artificial thing. It used to be, before there were watches and clocks, that you would do an activity until it was done. And there was no question about time. Let me change that. There was some question about time insofar as you wouldn't plant in winter. No. There were seasons. That was the apperception of time, that there were seasons. And there were seasons in which you would plant, and there were seasons in which you would harvest, and there were seasons in which you would migrate, and there were seasons in which the animals could be found here, and, you know, That was the smallest increment of time that you paid attention to before there were time devices. Kind of the seasons. And one of the things that frees us, here's a bit of gospel, in the tyranny of time, is to recapture at times the sense of doing a task for the task's sake instead of within a block of time. How does it change your perception of what you're doing, for example? Well, I'll give you an example. I don't like to cook, except on Sundays. And one Sunday, I said, Myron, for the strangest reason, I feel like making chocolate chip cookies. Now, you have to understand how weird that is. I don't like to bake cookies. I don't like to bake cookies because they burn. and I don't see very well. And so I don't get them out very well. And the only way they're not going to burn is you have to watch them all the time. Now, why don't I like doing that? Because most days of my life, I have 69 zillion other things to do. I have books to write. I mean, there's 15 of them in my computer that I want to be working on. I've got lessons to plan. I've got correspondence to do, you know. And cooking takes too much time. Now, why do I like it on Sabbath day?
Because
on Sabbath I don't do anything. I don't have any work to do. I don't have to make any lesson plans. I don't have to write any books. In fact, I won't write books. I won't write lesson plans on Sabbath day. Sabbath day is the day to be gifting and to be relationships. Now, I very much love my husband, and I know my very much husband loves very much cookies. So, you know, I absolutely had fun baking chocolate chip cookies. Because there was no, I've got to get this done in half an hour. It was as much time as the job takes. Doesn't matter. You just do the job to count the time instead of stick it into a period. We need to understand that the world has devised this breaking down of time. And that the world has devised it in a very tyrannical way and made it more and more legalistic over you. Because now, instead of the meeting happening when everyone arrives, which is the way in more primitive culture the meeting happens, when they all get there, then the meeting happens. And you don't have to finish the meeting by 9 o'clock. You finish the meeting when the business is done, right? But in our society, we have created hours. And we create these hours, and so we say it has to be at 7 o'clock, it has to be done at 9 o'clock, because you have to go to bed at 10 o'clock, because you have to get up at 6 o'clock, because you have to be to work at 8 o'clock. See, and so we are forced by the creation of hours into having to stick our meeting into this slot. And if I just understand that that's the tyranny, that helps me to make it less of a tyranny. You know, I have discovered that meetings happen a whole lot better if we forget about the time. You know, if we just do things according to how much time it takes. And jobs are a whole lot more fun for me if I do them not by, I've got to get this done by 6 o'clock. And if I instead just let myself go with how much time it takes to go. Now, the fact is that's technically impossible a lot of times. So here we have another dialectical tension. But my point one is just understanding that tyranny. And there you must realize that the modern world has increased the tyranny by making digital watches. Seriously, there's a very big difference between, oh, it's a quarter till, and it is 8:47.
Mm-hmm.
What difference does that make in your feelings about things?
Plus they beep at you.
What?
They beep at you.
Yeah, they beep at you. I refuse to have a digital watch. Because a digital watch breaks down an already difficult lifestyle that's broken into hours, into minutes or seconds. And it names them. It just increases the tyranny over me. Because now I not only have, I have about a quarter of an hour to finish this Bible study. You know, I've got 14 and a half minutes. Isn't that true? So it's just to give us a sense of how the tyranny has increased over the centuries. You know, I think all those poor people in the Middle Ages when they invented sundials, it changed their life dramatically. Before that, you just sort of watch, and oh, it's about time to stand over there. But now you got a sundial, you got to show up when a sundial hits this place. Thank God for cloudy days. You know? But then, because there were so many cloudy days, somebody invents some other. We went to the Museum of Time. Where was that? Someplace in Switzerland.
Neuchâtel.
Neuchâtel. And in this museum, they showed where all the development of timepieces over the course of history and how they get more and more accurate and how human beings want it. Now, you know, there can be a goodness about that, but do you see what a enslaving thing it is? Okay? So that's my point one. Now, point two, and that's the dialectical tension Amy raised, that there is a need for conformity. You know, we do need to know that we can go over and eat lunch at 12 o'clock. And that's real important, especially for those of us that are on insulin and have to time our shots. But it's very important for there to be cooks that decide they really will have a lunch there for us at 12 o'clock. And so we set up our schedule of the morning accordingly. Now, how can we bring some gospel into that dialectic? And part of the gospel is this whole notion of choices, that we would all agree it's a good choice to have lunch at 12. Don't you think it's a good choice? Mm-hmm. You know, and we think that is a wonderful choice, because about the middle of the day is when you're really hungry. I mean, it's a choice that makes a whole lot of reasonable sense. And what's so really wonderful, even better, is that there are some people who have chosen to live at Holden for the purpose of serving people in order that people might have food. And because they have made that choice of vocation, we can have the choice to have a meal. And because they've made that choice, then we, out of gratitude that they've made that choice, will gladly make the choice to have our sessions at such and such a time and end at such and such a time, because it matches their choices. Does that show you a process of bringing some gospel into it? I might not really want to work at 8 in the morning, but for the sake of the well-being of the community, I will work at 8 in the morning. Now, the reason why that's been lost in our society is because our society is so individualistic. We always think everything is my own tough choice, my own tough problem that I have to go to my job then. And I don't think about the well-being of the community. Now, thank God for factories, industries, corporations that are starting to realize that. And they're starting to make better choices. Like, for the well-being of the community, it's not good to have severe traffic jam at 5 o'clock. Let's give some people the option to come in earlier and leave earlier. Flex time, it's called. Now, that's a really smart thing, because that moves the tyranny of time into a little bit more gospel. Isn't that true? What are some other things that move time more into gospel, besides industries having flex time? Can you think of some more? That'll be a project for a working group. Because I want to go on and give you more input, and then we'll break out into groups. Point number three, out of these seven about tyranny of time. Point number three hinges on what is a wonderful concept. Will you yank this off? A wonderful concept with the Greeks, which is too bad that we stupid English-speaking people only have one word for time. The Greeks have two words. Chronos and Kairos. Chronos is from which we get chronology. Chronos is incremented time. That here's an hour, and it's broken down into minutes. And there's that many hours in a day. So chronological time, 1 minute follows after another. Kairos, how do we spell that? We spell that in English with a K. Kairos. The South African people came up with that wonderful Kairos document, which is saying that this is the opportune time for changing apartheid. Kairos is the moment, that's the perfect time. And Jesus talks about that a lot of times. And so does the Apostle Paul when he says, now is the day of salvation. Now is the time. Kairos is, in spite of whatever's happening chronologically, this is the perfect time. So Simon, my priest friend's phone call, that was the Kairos moment. And what was really funny when I told him that his phone call was an absolute answer to prayer, he said, no wonder I couldn't find your phone number last night. Now, the way to help us deal with tyranny of time, or one way to help us deal with tyranny of time, is in the midst of what is forced on us chronologically to look for the Kairos things. You know, I might have to go to work at 8 o'clock, and I hate going to work at 8 o'clock, but going to work at 8 o'clock, let me watch for, let me be open to, let me be aware of where Kairos moments might happen in that. So I didn't particularly like having cancer. Chronologically, it was at a very poor time. But Kairos, in the midst of it, wow, God just threw out a whole bunch of them. One day, I discovered that my surgeon was real philosophically minded, and we started getting into these wonderful philosophical conversations whenever I had an appointment to check about my surgery. And so I would just sort of egg him on to get into these philosophical conversations, because I thought, well, God's just doing something here. So one day we're philosophizing and we're talking about, I forget who, it was some ancient Greek philosopher, and he's going on and away, and all of a sudden in the middle he stops and he says, tell me, did Jesus Christ really have to rise from the dead? Do you have to believe that to be a Christian? I mean, whoo! Right in the middle of, he's supposed to be talking about my surgery and why it still hurts. About 5 minutes later, the nurse pounded the door and said, doctor, you have other patients waiting. But it was just one of those Kairos moments, you know? And if I was all caught up in the chronology of, this is a really poor time in my life to have cancer, and it's a really poor time for the surgery to have been unsuccessful in that he did some nerve damage, and so I have severe pain in my right side. I mean, chronologically, this is awful. But Kairos, I mean, that question just came out of the blue. Do you really have to believe Jesus rose from the dead? I said, well, I don't think that's a very good question. I wanted to prolong the Kairos moment, you know. And I thought, we might as well get him more interested in this matter. So he was real curious why it wasn't a good question. I said, well, a better question might be, does anything make sense if he didn't rise from the dead? I had to do something like that. And thank God the Spirit put that one into my mind. The reason why I had to was because I knew that pretty soon the moment was gone. And I had to give him something that was going to carry that Kairos moment into more of the chronological time. Do you see my point? So that one of the ways we can help with the tyranny of time is to find ways to extend the Kairos. You know? And it might be by the way we deal with other people. It might be with what we do with ourselves. You know, so I hate having to be at school teaching kids that don't really want to be there. How can I find Kairos moments in there? A moment when a kid is just really open to the, you know, something to happen with me and that kid. To really be open to those Kairos moments, those learning moments when the kids can really learn. Or whatever our jobs might be, to look for the Kairos in the midst of it. Four, and this might sound like law, but it's really gospel. One thing that really helps with the chronology, with the tyranny of time, is to acknowledge our brokenness. And by that I mean to name our limits. Why that's gospel is because it frees us from that law over you that you think you have to always say yes. Unless some of you are better at saying no than I am. But I don't say no very well. And fortunately, I had a good experience of it recently. Our congregation is undertaking a financial project to raise money to build a sanctuary. And I really want to be part of that because I think it's important what's going on with the people's attitudes. And so they asked me if I would chair the prayer vigil committee. And of course I want to be part of it. And it took all the courage I've ever had in my life to say no. But I said no. And that was so freeing to just acknowledge my brokenness. But see, why we don't say no very well is because we have to admit our vulnerability. And then you don't justify your existence. We want everybody to think we're capable of doing everything. And so we say yes to everything. Well, we are capable of doing everything, but we are broken. And it was very freeing to say to the person who asked me, you know, I'm not doing very well right now. I'm only in town 9 days this month. I don't have a secretary treasurer for my corporation. I'm having to do all this. This was before I broke my elbow. Thank God I said no. Because once I broke my elbow, that slowed everything down. But to acknowledge our limits and say, I'm sorry, I'm not coping with life very well right now, and so I can't take that on. It's very freeing. But it requires the humility of knowing our limits and saying our limits and naming them. 5. This also might sound like law, but it's gospel. We need to be aware that the principalities and powers are operative in time. Insofar as the technicization of modern society has created a milieu in which efficiency is the ultimate criterion. And that's demonic. And when I name it for the demonism it is, that frees me to use the spiritual weapons against that demonism. You know, in Ephesians 6, when it says, put on the armor of God, then we might be able to stand against principalities and powers. One of the ways principalities and powers operate is with this whole technological mindset that says you've got to be more efficient. And if I can name that for the demonism it is, it helps a lot. An example, one time at a church meeting, where we were trying to decide a very difficult thing, somebody said, we've got to hurry. We've got to make this decision so that the meeting can get over in time. And I said, since when is the chief criterion of making a decision efficiency? Is a decision better because you make it fast? Answer me that.
No.
But doesn't our world tell you that? Because efficiency is the ultimate criterion. I mean, you know efficiency is the criterion. Because look at everything. You got to have faster aspirins, faster fast foods, faster. Everybody's got to break the record on how fast they get your meal out. Isn't that true? Everything is, you want to go faster. Jacques Ellul did some study of fastness. And you know, in France, they have the speed train as opposed to the slow train, which still goes pretty fast. And he asked some people who took the speed train from Lyon to Paris what they did with the time they saved, and not a one could give him an answer. Why is there this impelling that you've got to go faster in our society, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to name that for the demonism that it is, that efficiency is not the criterion. And because our world makes it the criterion, we lose out on what really matters. I think that if a decision can't be made within the confines of this meeting, it ought not to be made. We ought to extend this decision until we can make it well, or change the parameters of our meeting, or change the parameters of the decision. That's what ruins friendships. You know, so much because we let the demonism of efficiency be the criterion. 6, contemplation as a spiritual discipline. Here's gospel again. Contemplation as a spiritual discipline is any way to unmask those illusions. Any way that we can expose the reality, and any way we can choose to not let it control us. So I might not even be able to solve the efficiency demand, but I might at least be able to name it, and that sets me free to some extent. Because I can name it as an oppressive power and then not let it control my psyche. It might control my chronology, but it doesn't have to control my psyche. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And let me move right on to seven. Connected with that is naming the idolatry of success as my result. You know, people chalk up their life on the basis of how much they accomplish rather than on the kairos moments. You know, I might not have gotten all my teaching plans done. I might not have taught this much curriculum, but one kid's life might have been rescued, and that's far more worth it. You know, so how do I rank my success as a teacher? Now here there's the bind, because the world ranks you on the basis of other things. So there's always the tension to do as much of the other as you can. But the point is, I myself ought not to rank myself that way. Or don't we in the world identify ourselves on the basis of how much money we make? You know, you're worth what your salary is. That rates you as a human being. Now, you know, that is just devastating to me. That is just devastating. Because I have a PhD and 4 master's degrees and I make $900 a month. I mean, that doesn't quite measure up to the world. That gives me a very low sense of self-esteem if I base my worth on how much money I make. Right? So we get gospel when we name the idolatries of these measures of our success and instead choose to look for different kinds of results that aren't under that kind of tyranny of time. Time equals money in our society. That's why I could use that other example. Time equals power, whatever. Okay? Let's move on to another idea. Those were my 7 points about the tyranny of time. One other idea, then I want to break you into groups for a few minutes. And that is setting priorities. This is another concept we have to think about in connection with time. A lot of people say, well, the way to solve your problem of time is list all the things you have to do and then prioritize them. What are the pros and cons of that? Just call some out. There's some good things and there's some bad things to that.
Time management.
You can make choices about what's most valuable to you.
Okay.
Flexibility.
You could weed out stuff that maybe you don't need to do after all.
That's enough.
Okay, what was the first pro or negative somebody said? Oh yeah, time management. There it is, that idolatry again. And name it as an idolatry. And then somebody said something else that was positive.
You can make a better choice about what you value.
Yeah. We make the better choice, we have the value. Sorry. That's value.
Do the things you like up front.
Yeah. It gives us our awareness of what we really like. And we can see the gospel in really being free to choose what we want to do.
So that's interesting, because I've gone to time management classes and they tell you to do just exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, you do the stuff you like the worst, you dislike, get it out of the way first.
And then reward yourself with the stuff you like.
Yeah. If there's time, there's probably not time.
If there's time.
If there's time. So that's why it says eat dessert first on some people's shirts.
Yeah. That's right. Life is short. Eat dessert first. Okay? Those things kind of summarize some of the best of the pros and cons of choosing priorities. How can we bring some gospel into choosing priorities?
Realizing the options.
Yes, and those options, let me gospel it to the hilt. When we realize the options, isn't our number one option to follow Jesus? Abbreviate that too. Our number one, my priority is I want to be like Jesus, right? And if that's my priority, then all my other choices, my priorities, are going to fall in line.
Now that helps me sometimes to do the worst first. Because sometimes to follow Jesus might be that this particular task needs to be done. I don't want to do it, but you know, I'm following Jesus and Jesus will do it. And so I'll do it. It takes the nastiness out of it. If I can do the stuff I don't want to do for the sake of Jesus. I remember one time I lived in a student apartment that didn't have any shelves, so I built shelves out of orange crates, which worked just fine, except orange crates are slats with holes in between. And the cream of wheat box was on the top, and it fell over. Cream of wheat all the way through every cupboard in there, because it went through the slats and around. And I tell you, I did not want to clean up that cream of wheat. But I've been talking a lot about living for Jesus with my students at the university, and it just amused me. I just thought, this is really funny. I do not want to clean up this cream of wheat, but it is Christ's cream of wheat after all. And I am Christ's servant. And you know, if Jesus would be standing right here and Jesus said, "Would you clean up my cream of wheat?" would I answer yes? Of course I would. I mean, and the more I thought about that, the more I got excited about the idea. I thought, this is really fun. I'm going to clean up the cream of wheat for Jesus, you know? I don't want to do it for myself, but I'll do it for him. So I cleaned up all the cream of wheat, and I really felt good about it. I was having a great time. And I got it all cleaned up, and it was winter, and I just threw it out in the yard, and a whole flock of birds came and sang me a song. I mean, I got a whole symphony for free just for cleaning up Christ's cream of wheat. Pretty good reward, right? Now, I know it's a stupid story, but it makes the point. The key to setting priorities be gospel instead of law is to remember that my primary priority is wanting to be Jesus, wanting to be like Jesus, wanting to be with Jesus, wanting to serve Jesus, wanting to let Jesus be the goal and focus of everything that I do. Well, let's break into working groups for a few minutes, and I'll tell you what they are, and you can pick which one you want to be in. And if we get no people in one, that's fine, I don't care. Here's some things I'd like people to theologize about. And this all has to do with my subject in this hour, which was the tyranny of time, and some understandings about time. I'd like some people who would be interested in this to think about enforced waiting. And think theologically about enforced waiting and spiritual disciplinely about enforced waiting. How can we bring gospel to, like, when we're stuck waiting for the doctor? Or like when we're stuck in a line at the post office? Is there any way to make gospel out of that? Okay? That's what I mean by enforced waiting. So think about that if you'd like to be in the group that's doing that. If you are, that group will sit over in that corner. So when we go into groups, you can just go over to that corner, okay? Here's another group. I'd like somebody to think theologically about time wasters, things like TV, things that you just sort of take brain out, pump this in, you know, stuff that's really time wasters. And I'd like you to think theologically about them. And to think theologically about them is to bring gospel in it, to say, well, if I'm a follower of Jesus, ought I to have any of that? Or is that something that I shouldn't do? I shouldn't ever waste my time? Or maybe there's a place for wasting time, and what are some constructive ways to waste time? Are these constructive or destructive ways to waste time? Do you see what I mean? To think about it theologically? Okay, so the time wasters group will be over in that corner if you want to be in the time wasters group. Okay. Then there's another group. I'd like you to think theologically about how to make time special. And here I'm not talking about kairoses, but like to celebrate a birthday. What do you do to make that time special? And how can we think theologically about that? You know, I've been to a lot of pagan birthday celebrations. And it seems to me it'd be really wonderful if God's people could set aside those special times to observe in a way that brought God into it more. Do you think that's a desirable goal? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's not a desirable goal. Maybe we ought to have special times to be pagan. So you can talk about that if you're in this group.
And that group that talks about special times will meet over there by the piano. Okay? And one last group, and I might not get any takers for this one, but that's fine. I'd like to know if anybody would be interested in talking theologically about schedules. And that is, if you are stuck with the daytimer, if you do have to schedule your life, and you're really stuck with having to schedule, is there a way to bring gospel into that? How can we let that schedule not be tyrannical over us? How can we have some gospel in that? And if you want to be in the schedules group, you can meet over here. Drag some chairs. Okay? Any questions about the groups? So we have enforced waiting people in that corner, time wasters in that corner, making special times that corner, and schedules this corner, and go whichever group you want for a few minutes, and just talk theologically about it, and then we'll spend a few minutes to come back. So you'll only have about 5 to 7 minutes. It's not a lot of time, but that's because we're past our schedule. So go into your group fast. I'm running to turn off the clock.
Schedules.
Here I am.
I don't want to do the answer.
Well, we didn't get a chance to do anything. I just said it got warmed up to the.
Okay, can we hear from the time when you've got enforced waiting group? The enforced waiting group, will you give us some of your best ideas? Now, let me say a thing. We purposely are leaving these kind of real open-ended. You can keep talking about it during your break time, talk about it over dinner. But I wanted to get the ideas on the tape so that people who have the tapes can have their own discussion groups about them. And I want to give at least a couple ideas so they can see what you did with it. Okay, but this is obviously just only a beginning because we are under this stupid necessity of time. But just give us some of your best ideas. First, we had the group that theologized about enforced waiting.
Enforced waiting. We felt that the waiting in line, when you're waiting for things, that's an opportunity. That's an opportunity for community and talking on a one-to-one or two-to-one. And the waiting on the phone when you are plugged from one operator and, you know, thank you for calling. We know your call is important. It's an ask.
But not important.
I'm sorry, we could hear that for the laughter.
Yeah. It's an attitude as to how you go into that, knowing this is what it's going to be and having the right attitude beforehand. I think that was, and just trying to keep that in mind.
Hmm. Some good ideas to get us started thinking about enforced waiting. Okay, let's hear from the time wasters group.
Come up with anything.
Yeah, we had nothing productive to.
It is the biggest group, too.
I expected you to come out with some profound statement about television or something.
Well, we did. You know. one was that, is it really waste time, or is it a gift from God to give us respite from the tyranny of schedule?
That's right. Okay.
It's our definition, I guess, of waste. Mm-hmm. Only we call it waste. Somebody else might say we were doing something productive.
Good. So if we're going to theologize further about it, we might want to make up some ways to think about, is this a resting that's, you know, a good resting, or is this a resting that maybe I'm escaping and should be doing something else, or, you know, to really think. And that's really good that you guys decided wasting is a misnomer. There's better questions to ask. Okay, let's look to the group about special times. Tell us some things you came up with.
I think kind of the gist of it was that you need to look for the kairos moment within a celebration. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily by, well, help me out here, folks, but not necessarily scheduling everything, or uh-huh. but sort of leaving some freedom for that kind of thing to happen and then to recognize it.
And considering altering your perception of it if it's not what you thought it would be, and thinking that perhaps there's joy found in this other thing.
Good, because aren't a lot of celebrations ruined because it didn't go like we wanted it to?
Yeah.
Very good, okay? And let's hear from the schedule group.
Well, we more or less just talked to find out what everybody did and what type of time constraints that people have in their jobs or whatever. And it's kind of a simplistic Pollyanna approach, but if you think that God, Jesus, is with you, standing next to you as your co-worker, and if the time is not met, God will provide. It's just something that you shouldn't be more so constrained to meet, and the Kairos moments will occur, and so forth. Even like worship, worship services, you know, it has to end at 11 o'clock or else it will, something will happen, but just kind of let it go, and it will provide. And you'll be able to minister to people or whatever, wherever you're at.
Thank you, all your groups, and I hope you'll carry on these conversations because I know you just got started. Let's close with prayer. Our times are in your hands, Lord. Help us to trust that and help us to live that with freedom. Amen.